Well, we have a first announcement we have to make. As probably most of you know, Dr. Sermonara has passed on, and therefore will not be able to give the lecture, of course, that is dated for next Sunday. Therefore, instead of Dr. Sermonara, our old friend Ron Hogarth is going to take it. He's been looking into the Hakeishi material and will do as best he can to cover some of the field that she had intended to cover. We all regret the passing of this good friend. I saw her not long ago up in Ojai, and she's really hoped to be able to be here. But after a long illness, this was not possible. So we all send her a good thought on her way and appreciate the many nice things she has done for us. This morning, we have a subject that is more or less highly modern. I remember in Grandma's day, and Grandma was quite a character, anyone over 65 retired from human life. They put on black, a little touch of white perhaps, a cameo pin. Of course, no hair dye ever touched their brows. They wore no makeup, flat-heeled shoes, and dressed almost entirely in conventional black. They then sat quietly on the porch and did the knitting, or perhaps occasionally acted as the senior hostess of some important family gathering. This was considered to be the proper way to meet the coming of the years. To do anything different was to bring considerable criticism from the neighbors. It was rather important to stay within the pattern. All this reminds us of a bit of Greek mythology. In the old classic texts, especially Hesiod in his Theogony, the kingdom of heaven passed to Saturn, who became king of the material world. He was an elderly gentleman in mythology, a rather pained expression, slender to distortion. He was winged sometime, but he also always carried a scythe and an hourglass. And in astrology at that time, he was assigned to that part of life after 65 years. Of course, the growth mythology goes a little further, but most people haven't noticed it. After this went on for a while, Jupiter tossed Saturn out and took over the kingdom himself. And Jupiter was of an entirely different temperament. Jupiter was philosophical, and as the word implies, he was jovial. He was wise and learned, religious, had much to do with self-improvement, and also had an irresistible sense of humor. It is said he was the chief of those upon high Olympus who, observing the happenings of mankind, laughed heartily. So now we find, according to the Greek mythology, that the period after 65 is under the keeping of a very jovial, happy, wise, and impressive personality who enjoyed not only the good things of life, but enjoyed learning and was the patron of wisdom and religion and most of the higher educations with which we are now associated. Now, the modern statistic findings, in spite of smog pollution and other things, is that we are living longer than we ever have before. And today, it is not at all unlikely that a person retiring from a business or occupational career at 65 will have 20 good, happy, useful years to do something with. And this has been the rub up to the moment. The whole psychology of the situation has made it very difficult for the individual to make the best use of the best years of his life. In early life, we all have burdens, we have responsibilities, we have the problems of taking care of family and the community. We are more or less bound to occupations which may or may not be very satisfying to our inner lives. And then comes the time that they've all been looking for, when at last there would be freedom from this labor. The freedom was not entirely without restriction, because in many cases, freedom meant to reduce the standard of living considerably, to try to get along on a pension and a little social security. These factors ensured probable physical salvation, but restricted the spending power of the individual at that time of life when he might enjoy spending it the most. So, this problem of retirement begins in school when you start out. A life has to be planned. We have to give proper consideration to the changing needs of our own dispositions and natures. It is not enough merely to live day by day, spend day by day, and keep all the funds that come to us going out as rapidly as possible. There is something to be said, therefore, for planning financial life and income, and remembering that the money that we save when we're young can help us to have a much better time when we get older and know how to appreciate a good time a lot better. Also, that this type of life, in the more advancing years, we have more interest in valuable good times, opportunities to do important things. So we face two restrictions. One is that the money's gone, and the second is that we hit this period of life around 65 without any planned future. We kind of take it for granted that we are going to drift in some form of semi-comfort and pleasure through the closing years of life. But these closing years can sometimes be very long, and funds and opportunities and interests have a tendency to lag. The time when the person was perfectly willing and happy to settle down and do nothing and consider this a notable and valuable reward for a career, this type of thinking is going out of style very rapidly. We must now, therefore, begin to think of the years after business retirement, if we retire at that age, as a second career, not merely a waste of time. We cannot hope to fulfill life by sitting in front of a television set until finally we slip away into the other world. We have time to do things, and we have to have interest in doing them. So we begin to look to see what's the matter at a time when we should be preparing for a very adventurous period of reasonably good health and opportunity. Well, in the first place, everyone should be a two-career person from the start. We should never be completely absorbed in one thing, especially if that one thing has physical limitations or economic limitations. The doctor, for instance, the old family physician, really didn't worry much about retirement. He never retired as long as he was able to walk. His career might extend far beyond the 60 or 70 years that was the measure of economic careerism. He was just as useful, just as happy, and just as busy at 80 as he was at 50. But in many cases, this doesn't work very fortunately. The individual who has a training in one thing comes to the point where that one thing is no longer enough or even available. And then there's a blank for which there's been no preparation, no understanding of the need to have a wider area of mental and emotional relevance, consideration of values and factors. The person, therefore, should always have a second string on his bow. Now, this can begin way back early in life. In university or in school, he may have a major and a minor. He may have two definitely different courses which could help him to diversify his own interests. Business, however, has a tendency to limit him, to make him more and more isolated from the general world and centered in the particular occupation which he has accepted. Therefore, we begin to say when people are 30 or 40 or 50 years old, it is high time to begin to give a lot of thought to a secondary career. It isn't as difficult as people might imagine. Psychiatrists and psychologists realize that in many instances, the individual has a second career submerged. And it is this submerged second career that has been making life difficult for him ever since he started out. He has always had something he wanted to do and never could do, or didn't believe he could do. And as a result, there was a frustration that affected even the career in which he was properly oriented.
Please, you're talking 2 weeks' lecture ahead.
Have I got the wrong title?
You've got the wrong title.
Well, how is that? All right, we'll keep right on from here. I looked at the program before. By the time I got through, maybe you would never have known the difference. But actually, here we are, right on the problem we're talking about. We need second career. We come into the world, get stuck in something that we are doing, and in this state of being limited and restricted, we factually have no recourse but to go on in this rather lazy way. Well, if we're going to use this subject, we can say that we do bring some of our troubles with us either this world. In fact, many of us, I think, bring most of them. But the troubles that we bring into the world manifest in our careers. We face them every time we take a job. We face them when we go to school. We find some students are active and sufficient, others limited and unable to fulfill even common educational responsibilities. We find some who are born optimists and others pessimists. And we find each individual working toward some kind of a life security. Now, it may well happen that the actual fields of endeavor, which his latent talents will bring into play, are not available at the environment where he is living today. It is also quite possible that the individual was in the previous life ahead of his time, and is still so, that he has been dreaming of a utopian dream of the future, for which he gave his previous life, and the earnings and yearnings of which he brings into the present one. So we can bring into it, life as it is, all kinds of unfinished business. And the problem of what to do with our life when we get here is probably the most important of the unfinished business. So, to go back to the subject we started out in, we take a job, we work through it to retirement, and then we are lost. Whatever the compulsion is from some previous embodiment, if there was one, and that is one compulsion, has been killed by the pressures of immediate circumstances. We have gradually been forced to sacrifice ourselves and our purposes for the well-being of those around us or for whom we have unusual regard and affection. So we come in with certain talents, very often have no opportunity to use those talents, and then finally end in a rather routine business situation which rewards us only financially. Well, the financial reward is important, and to some people their profession is well satisfying. They enjoy it, they do well with it, and they continue on to the end. But here again we come to this problem of how are we going to get out of the mysteries of the subconscious, or that from which we have spawned the present embodiment, and fulfill more of the greater part of ourselves. if it is true that we bring into here a vast amount of unfinished business, it is very probable that this unfinished business has something to do with more than earning a living. The human nature, the soul in man, is not economically oriented. The body has its requirements, and most persons sacrifice all else to the requirements or satisfactions of the body. So whatever else came along has had very, very little consideration. In a highly industrialized world, such as we live in now, it is quite possible that the average person in his regular career cannot afford to think, cannot afford to dream, cannot afford to hope for a better way of life. He must stay with what he's doing. But then comes this period in which he is no longer a servant of his physical conditions, unless he chooses to be. So somewhere in this mystery is the possibility of unfolding potentials after the burden of regimented existence is passed. So we could say that we have at least 15 or 20 years in life in which we can release parts of our nature which have had practically no expression in our daily contacts with existence. Somewhere in each person there is an inner life that must have some expression. And to go out of this world without having an opportunity to develop some of the internal initiatives of our lives is a sad and tragic but all too common thing. We are gradually changed into elements of an economic or industrial machinery. And in this we must remain until the bitter end. But with the coming of Social Security, pension systems, and matters of that nature, the bitter end does not have to be one of complete involvement in survival, trying to get along on a restricted income, trying to find what pleasure one can without the money to do it with. And looking back on the vast amount of money that may have been wasted along the way, which would be more useful after 65 than it was before 65, we begin to philosophize, and the empire of our older years comes under the rulership of Jupiter rather than Saturn. We are all looking more than any other way and any other thing for the solution to the needs of the inner life. These are the needs that press forward out of the past. Actually, we think of the human being as born and dying in this world. But actually, the human being is a long creature in existence. It has survived ages. It has gone forward through degree and culture after culture. It has been part of countless civilizations. It has spoken many languages. It has followed many paths and comes now into the world with certain responsibilities and needs. It is almost certain that one of the most important traits of character that we have to develop in our present embodiment is discrimination. To find out what it is that will do the most for the greater part of ourselves. This little material island that we call the body is actually surrounded and permeated by the great ocean of spiritual space. There is a tremendous universality in which we live and move and have our being. This universality tells us of the tremendous potential in ourselves, but we have very little opportunity to do anything with it and very little incentive. Everything that we do here narrows us more and more into the physical environment. Now, if the world environment physically was in a happy condition, if we could prove beyond question of doubt that we learn more in the material world than we can possibly digest in a lifetime, then perhaps this physical condition would be worthwhile. But for the most part, we are blocked in learning. We are prevented from thinking. We are restricted in our efforts to enlarge our own horizons or deepen our own understanding. If we depart from the conventional patterns of things, we are considered eccentric and penalized. So we bring into this world all kinds of possibilities, all kinds of arts and sciences that have, some of them, no longer any contemporary existence, but could well be revived for the common good. We also bring within ourselves this great hunger to grow, an infinite desire to expand and enlarge and enrich the total pattern of our existence. In order to do this, we must have time. We must have opportunity. We must have considerable interest in doing these things. Therefore, we come back again to the fact that we all have to buy, in one way or another, a certain amount of leisure time with which to use for thought. We have to pay out of our daily wages for the privilege of being thoughtful, intelligent, conscientious persons. We are not just given this. We have to do it ourselves. The majority of persons claim that after they have done a day's work, they are too tired to consider other matters. So they waste many hundreds of thousands of hours in some kind of entertainment that does not entertain. So the planning of a time to grow brings into focus this problem of the second subject that I've just received here. And that is, do we bring our troubles with us into this world? We do not necessarily bring troubles. Rather, we bring the capacity for trouble. We bring into this world with us attitudes which can well lead to trouble. We also bring into this world a kind of freedom which has a great inducement to get us into trouble. We have the right to do as we please, and when we do it, we frequently are the worse off. So that we can bring into the world unfinished business, undisciplined attitudes, and unconditioned levels of consciousness which doom us to trouble. A trouble probably arises primarily from lack of experience. In some previous embodiment, we haven't learned certain lessons. So when the problems come up again, we are in a bewilderment. We are not capable of coping with them. So one of the things we have to do as we come into this world is to determine to accomplish something to get out of our own troublemaking device. We have to begin to think about things that perhaps we would rather not consider. One person may come into this world with an unconditioned, unrestricted impulse to worry. They have been a worrier perhaps for 20 lives or more. And the more they worried, the more really they had to worry about. Because worrying was not producing any consequential results worthwhile. So the person who has been a worrier since the dawn of time comes in for a short journey here through his environment, which we call daily living. He will worry himself from the cradle to the grave, and in the course of doing it will probably worry nearly everyone he knows. Worry is something that gradually paralyzes his own initiatives, fills him with fears and doubts, creates burdens that exist only in his own mind, and finally condemns himself to a hypochondria involving not only his physical body, but his mental and emotional structure as well. So here we come. If we are worriers, and we notice that we are inclined to worry, then the thing to do is to take it on as a problem immediately. It is never too young to start. Perhaps we don't realize that it is a problem till we hit our teens or something of that nature. But the moment we notice that it is a discomfort and a restriction upon constructive effort, the time has come to go to work with it. Now, another individual coming into this life may have been a Caesar somewhere in the background, or one of the generals of Alexander, and he comes into the world with only one tremendous purpose, ambition. He feels that he is destined and foreordained to run people, to dominate situations, to become powerful and wealthy, to become a great industrialist or a famous militarist. He comes in for the purpose always of having his own way and dominating and enslaving the minds of those around him. As a husband, he is a terrible mistake. As a wife, no better. So that all the way along, he is a victim of an inordinate belief that he was created for the purpose of running other people. Well, in the course of life, he learns a lot of lessons and goes out of here with many scars, which he never needed, and perhaps and probably never does learn the lesson that he was supposed to learn, the lesson of gently and humbly accepting the responsibilities of daily life and contributing to the happiness and security of others rather than the dominant development of his own career. So he has wasted a life by failing to change his own pressures of personality. Then there may be another type of person that comes along who is very strongly theologically inclined. Perhaps for many lives they were in religious houses. Perhaps they were monks or nuns or belonged to some other religion in other parts of the world. But they come in with nothing on their minds, actually, but a tremendous religious intensity. Quite young in life, they probably join some religious organization as a natural expression of their pressures, and then settle down very often to an unreasonable frustration in which, instead of growing and learning and helping and serving, they simply settle down into the idea that piety, that the constant saying of prayers, the constant reading of scriptures, and the practice of certain physical austerities will fulfill life. These people succeed in going through the entire problem of existence without actually solving any of the real pressures of their own natures. Beneath or around this religious intensity, there is always the problem of social adjustment. These people avoid that and ignore it. Instead of rising to meet a problem head on and solving it, they hide, taking refuge behind walls or psychological shrines to escape the challenge of daily living. These people are unable to cope with life, and this lack of coping is the result of having failed long ago to learn the lessons of adjustment. So they come in with tremendous pressures, which are unable to lead them to any successful or constructive end. Then, of course, there are always those groups that arise with tremendous intensities in various fields of art, music, drama, religion, philosophy, education, science. There are the born scientists, the born opera singers, the born musicians, the child of 10 who is a mathematical genius. These types of individuals come in all the time, bringing with them assets out of the past, but for the most part also bringing them with them liabilities. These tremendously intense people gradually become so immersed in a particular field of activity that they forget or choose to ignore the large problems of life. They consider that if they are a great artist, they have done it all. If they can exhibit in the salon, they are a success. If they can find a new gadget for some industrial house, they are inventors. Each of these persons has his own little world. And history, biography, and the records that we all have show that these little worlds are not always very satisfactory. We find the great musician whose private life was a complete problem. We find a man like Richard Wagner, who was one of the great musical geniuses of all time, whose physical life was simply unbelievably confused. He never did straighten it out. Then we find somebody else who has great depths in invention and things of that nature, but has done nothing to fulfill the needs and responsibilities of a family, or the raising of children, or the problems of daily living. So little by little, these specialists isolate themselves from the great course of life. They forget humor. They forget the joy of living. They lose touch with nature. They become hopelessly involved in projects. Projects which belong to a world which is changing. The inventor of some gadget makes quite a reputation while he's here, but 50 years after he's gone, the gadget is obsolete. He has done nothing to perpetuate the better part of anything. So behind all specialized occupations, all specialized careers, is the basic problem of living in this world, which appears to be the reason why we are here. Living in this world means to have a useful life, helpful, constructive, cooperative. A life in which the inner nature of the individual has an opportunity to express itself through joy, through love and affection, through respect and friendship, and through mutual service to the common good. As we look at these adjustments, it becomes obvious that nearly everyone has within himself the capacity for several such adjustments, but does not make use of them. Rather, continues in his own narrow way, leaving this world no better than he found it, and perhaps a little worse. This type of situation has to be faced by everyone who believes in reincarnation, who believes that they are here, as Buddha pointed out, for one reason only, that they are not perfect. If we were perfect, we wouldn't be here. If we made no mistakes because we had learned everything there was to learn, then the infinite wisdom of nature would not lock us in common circumstances again. It is what we never did well that we have to do now. It is what was never finished that has to be completed. Therefore, there is no question in the world that the mere presence of the individual here is a definite proof of shortcomings, of limitations. Of course, I know we've had people come to us and they admitted all this. They said they had shortcomings, but they didn't make any difference because the thing they wanted to do, they had achieved. They had done the one thing they wanted to do. I remember one in particular who had no success in life in anything, but they were happy because they had achieved the one goal they wanted to achieve. They were singing grand opera. Well, that was a goal that was pleasant and happy. But to this end, everything else was sacrificed. And it was not even regarded as a sacrifice. It was the means of the fulfillment of one pointed determination and ambition. And the better economists today tell us this one-pointedness is the secret of success. But when we succeed in one thing, does this success enrich all of our life? Or does it just simply give us a little satisfaction and leave us surrounded by a sea of misfortunes? Does the individual who finally came to be a singer, does that individual have a good home life? Are they happily married? Do they have wisely governed children? Are they respected in their community? Do they have a strong and sufficient religious life? Very often, the only thing they have is the thing they've specialized in. And, of course, music, like all other things, is limited to a large degree to physical existence. And the individual whose body becomes tired or whose faculties become exhausted loses the one ability that they think they have. So, we come into this world in order to learn something that we didn't know before. And to get back to the subject I talked about first, they're going to stay that way, probably, until retirement. Because up to that time, they have no individuality. They are the servants of a system. They are dependent upon an organization for a living. They must obey the will of their leaders. The head of the department tells them what they can do and often what they can think. They have all kinds of burdens, all centering on the problem of paying the rent, having food, raising a family, and trying to maintain a certain sense of contentment in an embarrassing and difficult position. So these people do not, for the most part, reach retirement with very much out of life except a job. Now, this doesn't mean that they spend all their time being miserable. They go away on vacations. They have pleasant times with their families. They see the scenery. They travel. And they have developed all kinds of radio and video games and things of this nature. And some of them rise to the height of rock music. They have a good time, and they sit and watch baseball games and sit there with their eyes glued to the plays and feel that that is a tremendous fulfillment. By working hard and earning the price of the TV set, they have the right to sit beside it or in front of it every evening for 2 or 3 hours to watch programs that are for the most part worthless. But this is relaxation. This is success. This is the thing the individual has labored for so industriously and sometimes so painfully. Well, it goes on that way. People don't change too much in these things. Some of them develop nice and interesting hobbies. Some of them take on social activities. And there are compensations. It's not all miserable. The individual has a kind of feeling that he's getting along as well as the next. But somewhere along the line, the problem of growth still does come into the picture. Man is a many splendored being. He's a tremendous creature. The human being is unbelievably magnificent in potential and in resources. That this individual should spend all his time tightening a bolt in an automobile just does not seem to be the proper destiny. This destiny must have something else in it. Now, if he has to make a living by this tightening this bolt, that's all right. He has a right to be and make a living. But by making a living, he earns certain time for himself. He gains certain freedoms and certain liberties. Because he works, he has a home. Because he has a home, he has a vacation. He has all kinds of privileges also. But what does he do with them? Does he do anything more with his spare time than he does while he's tightening the bolt in the factory? It is just a narrow squirrel cage of activities. Now, by the time he gets to the point of retirement, he is more or less anxious to rest. And this problem of looking forward to rest is probably the greatest delusion in the world, because there is nothing more boring after the first 2 weeks. The individual with nothing to do is supremely miserable. So he has to find more artificial things to keep his mind off of his own uselessness. So he takes on all kinds of activities, perfectly aware that they don't mean anything. But after all, you just can't sit and look at the sky forever. Now, there's where the growth factor could come in. If we brought back from some previous life unfinished business, we should be able to do something to interpret those working years which have preceded this retirement period. We now have a life of many years of social contacts and social involvements to look back on. We can think how we handled a marriage. We can wonder if the divorce was necessary. We begin to consider what might have happened had we raised the children a little differently. And had we learned to do things that were important instead of buying that expensive car? Were we justified in putting every nickel we had into something the moment we got it, so that to the end of our business career, we were never more than a few months ahead of debt? Was this a good life? After we've lived it and can think about it, we can also wonder what we didn't have that might have made it better. we begin to have our own book, our own life as a textbook for growth. We are able to begin to estimate how we could have used things better. And the moment we make this estimation, our consciousness helps us to make these things better. It gives us the learning. The incidents do not end in learning. It is our understanding of the incidents that ends in learning. What happens is not the meaningful thing. It's what we think of what happened, what we do about what happened, what we learn from what happened that helps us to grow. These are the things that, therefore, the person can contemplate from a higher perspective of life. He also can have his religious life enriched. He can have all these things made more important because he does not have to conform with the requirements of an industrialized civilization. So, if he starts, say, at about 30, 40 years old to understand these things, he can then do something to fulfill the laws of nature, the great laws of growth. Here we have in this world about nearly 5 billion human beings, most of whom go through the spans of life with little or no insights. The majority of people are simply wandering through the years, some of them suffering through the years, trying to understand the reason for their own existence and finally giving up in despair. They have not any real skill in understanding or estimating their own natures. Somewhere in education, there should be courses to help people to understand themselves. Not psychological courses to find out what's the matter with them, but rather philosophical and educational courses to help them to know what to do to unfold and release the potentials within themselves. It is quite obvious that, for instance, computerization is not a potential. The individual was growing long before there were computers, and he will continue to grow long after they are forgotten. The problem is, if he devotes his entire life to learning such a thing as that, he dies no wiser than before. It may not even be that these instruments will be in use the next time he comes around. There are many things we've learned in the past that were no use and will never survive. But what we had to learn in the past was how to grow. And if we didn't learn that, all the rest was a mistake or a failure.